founder and fan of Brown Rap Talent on the mic, bring my friend Dr. Rob Carpenter, who I talked to once. He was a referral from past Rondering's guest, Russ Finkelstein, to chat about Dr. Rob's career, from author to public speaker to academic to Hollywood, you know, entertainment person to a lot of other things. And so Dr. Rob is good at a lot of things, written 5 books. I mean, he's just a really fascinating person who's just really insightful. So folks, you're really going to enjoy this episode. So thank you, Dr. Rob, for being on. And we're sponsored by Leverage Publishing Group. We ghostwrite, edit, and publish first-time authors. Peace. Gosh, I am so excited. I'm always excited when I do my podcast, right, Rondering's Universe? But I'm super duper excited because we're talking to a fellow multi-hyphenate, my friend, Dr. Rob Carpenter, who's published 5 books, screenplays, all kinds of things. I mean, Doctor, I don't think I can keep up with all of the things you do. So I'll let you describe that a little bit for the audience before we kind of chop it up. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much, Ron. I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you, my friend, and with all of your wonderful listeners and viewers. It's an absolute pleasure. Happy New Year to you. I know we're recording in the early parts of the new year. I'm just doing great. How are you? It's really been an incredible first part of the year.
It has been much better than 2023 felt. 2023 was rough. It was definitely a roller coaster. Coming into these first week of 2024, it's felt markedly different, and yet it feels like it's been moving really fast. I don't know by the time we publish your podcast how fast things will feel then, but like right now, things feel really fast. I also started so that's part of it. Like literally, like day two of my job, right?
Absolutely. So. And it also feels like time accelerates for a number of reasons. One, as we age, we tend to have more time that we can look back on. And so when we're 5, the year is slow, the summer is slow, school is slow. When we're 10, it's a little less slow. When we're 20, it's a little less slow. And then as we continue to age, time seems to accelerate. The other thing is, I'm just wondering if there is some sort of ticker clock that seems to be speeding up time in general, because it does seem to be going quite fast. And I think that can be a good thing. But the idea for me is, how can we slow ourselves down to the speed of enjoying what time we have, to the speed of enjoying our moments in the day, to the speed of really just being satisfied and saturating and marinating in the presence of that enjoyment,
even
when life is going fast.
Yeah. One of the things I wrote, my wife and I do a New Year's manifestation yoga practice. So shout out to KK Clivio and Tanya B for doing the 2024 virtual New Year's manifestations yoga practice that I think 80 or 90 of us from across the world were on January 1st. And when you spoke about being at a speed to be able to enjoy, one of the manifestations, well, mantras that I wrote was that I will be at the speed where I could be present. If you think about that, right, being present has varying speeds. Sometimes you're moving fast. Sometimes you need to really soak it all in. And so it's one of the mantras I've put out in the universe explicitly for 2024, because I want to be able to really be present. And being present, dependent on the context of the situation, may mean I have to move more quickly than other times. I just don't know. But I put that out there to like kind of bring that into my space to understand that.
Can essentially mean that we are more aware of ourselves and we're more aware of other people. And I feel the more aware we are of ourselves and others, the more present we are, and vice versa. And so I think one of the things that can trip me up sometimes, and probably a lot of people who are very successful and who are really trying to achieve their dreams and their goals, is when we move fast and we're not present, we tend to lose sight of other people. We tend to become more transactional in our thinking and in our behavior. And so I love what you're putting out there, because this idea that we can, in fact, slow things down so that we see ourselves and feel heard, and with ourselves first, and then make other people feel heard. It's one of the greatest gifts, I think, that we can live in and that we can put out for other people. to be a fully present and aware human being. It's rare, number one. And number two, when you do experience it, it is one of those transformational events. And it's hard to move away from or to leave behind because you want to experience it again and again. It's like a different kind of dopamine that is being introduced to our system.
Yeah. Well, speaking of gifts, Rob, I'd love to hear your story. What's Rob Carpenter's story?
Ooh, that's good. I have a short and a long version, but long story short, I was born in California and I'm part Black, part white, part Native American. But I grew up with two white parents in a mostly Latino neighborhood with Jewish and Asian best friends. And so my life is like a kaleidoscope. I moved to the Midwest. I moved to the East Coast. I've lived sort of in different parts of the world. And I think I've really been able to see lots of different perspectives, both ethnic perspectives, geographic perspectives. And in my own career, I didn't realize that I had such a taste for or lust for different types of careers and expressing sort of myself in different ways. So I've done that in politics, in campaigns. I've done it in startups where I started a startup, sold a startup that was investor backed. I've done it in multiple movies I've worked for, being a professor at UCLA, I've done it in books. And so I think for me, probably the biggest takeaway in terms of my life story is being able to see multiple perspectives about life. I think especially in the time we're in now, Ron, we are kind of in a black and white era and where it's like it's one thing or the other. And the way I just look at the world is it is full of multiple colors and multiple possibilities. And so I think that's kind of me in a nutshell. But I've really been able to be blessed to experience a lot of great things educationally and professionally and socially. Yeah. And not really anything I intended to do. People call me a Renaissance person. You're very much a Renaissance person. We are not a common breed of people, although in terms of actually going out and doing multiple things. But yeah. I do feel we are common in the sense of many people have that desire and want to figure out how do I become that Renaissance person in actuality, because I feel it in my mind, my thinking, and I feel it in my heart. And I want to do this. And so that's kind of my story of being able to live lots of different lives, be shaped by many different types of people. I used to think of it as a disadvantage because I didn't fit a cookie cutter box. Like I wasn't just one kind of person or I didn't grow, you know, yeah. And I realized actually it's an advantage because life is so much bigger than the black and white. Life is full of colors.
Yeah. I could see why. I got to shout out our friend, coach, mentor extraordinaire, Russ Finkelstein, for connecting them, right? Who's also audience, as y'all know, you listen to Ronderings. He was a podcast guest of mine earlier on in my Ronderings, right? And he speaks something very similar, very different story the way you describe yourself. But like, I think there's this thing like, I've often found as one pattern of becoming a Renaissance person, a multi-hyphenate. I mean, there's all kinds of terminology that I've heard about this is not feeling like you fully fit in any one environment. That upbringing at some level, whether it's having had divorced parents, right? Whether it's having multiple, like, you know, identities like you state, you know, being Black, white, Native American, right? There's something about that. And unfortunately, in some ways, the way the society has seen us, which I'd love to dig into with you a little bit in your upbringing, that I think at some level, a reaction to that is to create our own space and be lots of things to others because that's what we had to do. Mm-hmm. Right. So that fascinates me so much. I don't want, like, I'm not a social scientist and, you know, people have to do research, but this is, if I think about the Ronderings guests that I've had with folks who I tend to disproportionately have guests who are multi-hyphenates and Renaissance people, by the way, Renaissance women, Renaissance men, Renaissance folks across the gender spectrum. Right. Because I'm really fascinated about someone's story to be able to have that, right? So tell me a little bit about like how your upbringing shaped your sense of who you are, because that's always a journey for all of us.
Absolutely. And thanks for bringing up Russ Finkelstein. He is an absolute gem of a human being. And he's got a brilliant mind and a kind heart. And I think that combination is extremely rare, as do you, Ron, and I'm sure many of your listeners in the same way. In my upbringing, I never sort of questioned my identity because it was just what it was. It was kind of the default reality. And I think my biggest assumption was everybody had an experience like me. So when I moved to Ohio, I moved to a little town named Dresden. It was actually a village. It wasn't even a town. Google classifies it as a village because there's only 1,000 people. And it was famous for the world's largest basket and the world's largest basket building. And basically, people would come from all over the world to pay for these $50,000 handwoven baskets. It's a very, very strange place. And I'll say as an aside, that's actually when I became an entrepreneur for the first time. I was 9 years old, and I decided to start my first business. And so I'd go from home to home in the neighborhood. I'd pick people's flowers from their yards. I'd wrap them in a bow, then I'd sell them back to them. And so I had a kind of a knack for it until people realized, wait a second, these flowers are actually coming from our own yard. But it was actually when I was in the small town, which was all white. There were no Asian Americans. There were no, you know, Latino Americans, no Black Americans. It was all white, a little country town. And that's when I experienced racism, colorism for the first time. And people calling me the N-word and people questioning my skin tone and people wanting to touch my hair. And there was one moment in particular, we were out at a restaurant, my sister and I, and, you know, with our two Caucasian parents, and the waitress came up when the meal was over and said, is it going to be one check or two? And my sister and I were little kids, as if we would be paying for this meal. And I think that kind of struck me and realizing that my experience growing up was very different than other people's experience, because partly before that, being in California, that was never a thing, and being around such a diverse group of people. And so I realized that, I'm different. And I didn't really struggle with it in terms of an identity, but I did realize that being a minority in a community that didn't look like me would force me to start to negotiate multiple types of identities. So I'd have to negotiate the majority culture. Then I'd have to negotiate pretty much my own identity, because there was no minority culture, because there weren't any people that looked like me. When I moved back to California, and then when I moved to other places professionally later on in life, what I realized was that people who, whether they're ethnically minorities or whether they're multi-hyphenate, because we're minorities as well, Renaissance people are minorities, we have to negotiate multiple identities. So what that means at our core is we have to explore different things. We have to think outside of those proverbial boxes or those categories that maybe people who follow a more set path don't. So if people go into banking or into law or in medicine or into consulting, and those are great professions, but oftentimes there is a straight pathway and you don't have to negotiate the type of things that you do if you're an entrepreneur, and you have to, or if you are trying to be, a financier and also something else. And so I think for me, that upbringing, the first experience in Ohio in the country village, and then later on, as I started to get interested in politics and get interested in startups, get interested in entertainment, one of the things I realize is that each of these industries have their own way of thinking. They have their own jargon. They have their shorthand. They have their own prejudices. They have their own in-groups and out-groups. And even if you've excelled in one industry, it doesn't necessarily mean that they'll be open to you in another industry, unless you're a name that's maybe extremely well-known, in which case people embrace you a little bit more. But if you're one of those people who, like I always like to say, in many of my early experiences, I was a minor character in a Charles Dickens novel. So I was there around these great figures, Ron. But I wasn't that person, but I was able to observe and experience and take the good and reject the bad. But one of the things I realized is, for example, I'd worked in presidential politics, and I went into transition, though, to startups. And I was pitching my first tech company. And I remember one of the technology investors came up and said, well, I think your experience is fascinating. I know that you've learned a lot. You've raised a bunch of money in politics. You've done those things, but that's just all that's good for is cocktail conversation. And I remember thinking to myself,
oh my,
being dismissed because he, in his schema, in his thinking, he couldn't understand that there are transferable skills from politics to startups. And I found the same thing when I transitioned from startups, entertainment, and beyond that, people didn't understand or assume, if they're mirrored in their industries and entrenched in them, that you actually could bring other things that you've learned that could be applicable and relevant and helpful for the job that you're taking. So one of the things that I found is, if you want to be a multi-hyphenate, if you want to be this Renaissance person, typically you have to start over again each time you transition out. So if you're 20 and you do a certain job and then you transition to something else, 25, you're starting over again. Or 30, you're starting over again in terms of the eyes of the other people. Now, it's interesting because people, they will always sort of retroactively look back and say, well, you're an incredible success. But when you're going through that experience, you won't necessarily get the kind of validation that you want, particularly from the people that have never been through what you're going through.
So I'm fascinated by this idea of starting over again, right? As a concept to move across sectors, right? Politics to startups to entertainment, right? So what does that look like for you?
I think for me, because I love learning, big part of it is the challenge of seeing how quickly can I learn the things that I need to learn. Robert McNamara, who was Secretary of Defense under President Kennedy, and prior to that, he was head of the Ford Motor Company. Then after he was SecDef, he was head of the World Bank. And so very different industries. And they would always ask him, how could you be head of an automobile company, Secretary of Defense, and then head of a finance group? Because they're so different. And at least that's how the world portrays it. And he said to whoever asked him that, 90% of my job is the same across the industry. I have to set a vision. I have to be able to learn how to work with people. I have to negotiate complexities and problem solving. I have to be creative. And then 10% of any of the different roles were things I had to learn. I had to learn the technical aspects. And so going in with that mindset of, there's not a lot of difference, for example, between politics and startups and entertainment, and that they all have a beginning. And so whether it's beginning of a campaign, or you have a vision for a startup, or you want to do a movie, they all have that kind of messy middle where you're struggling through the process of achieving the dream, and they all have an end, whether it's an election for a campaign, for a startup, if you sell the company, take it public, or if it fails, or with a movie, if it finishes, and then, of course, gets distributed. So I saw these parallels between them, and I realized that, okay, there are only certain technical things that I have to learn. So when I realized I didn't have to learn a lot of things that you do when you're a student, you're going into a job, that I just had to learn, okay, I became a director, as an example. So I had to learn the technical side of directing and cameras and lighting and that sort of thing. But the leadership side, I already knew from my days in the startup world. Right. I already knew from politics. I knew that people, they want a vision. They want to be inspired. They need to be left alone to do their own job. They need to know that you're available there to troubleshoot when problems arise. And actually, it's interesting. People always ask me, what problems did you see? What industry produced the most problems? And one of the things that I saw from, again, my narrow vantage point was in entertainment. As a director, that was the job that I actually had to solve the most problems in, because it's just constant. They're technical problems, they're people problems, they're problems of nature where you may not be able to film certain places, and it's much more fast moving than many of the other experiences I had, even as a startup CEO, which I was. I didn't have to solve as many problems in real time. You still have to solve problems, but they're more strategic in nature, not like when you're a director, strategic and tactical, where it's just, if you don't solve it right now, then the ripple effect can be very, very challenging. And so it's been interesting kind of seeing those similarities, but it takes some educating of other people. And I think people like us who are multi-hyphenates and like your audience, we're more susceptible to believing that because we ourselves walk that out or want to walk that out. But I think for other people, it requires them to expand their perspective and their schema because they think that there's only one or two right ways to view the world and show up in it. And then when somebody else has been skipping and dancing in a different way, they look at them as odd and say, I don't know if I want this person in my world because they're so different. But eventually people will warm up and they'll see it, but not everybody. It takes, because it requires them to change. anytime Ron enters a situation as a multi-hyphenate, it requires them to adjust their thinking because they've never seen you before. You're essentially a unicorn going in. And it's like, wait, I just thought horses existed. I didn't realize there are actual unicorns that existed.
Yeah. And something you said about from using Robert McNamara as an example, right, reminds me of a Harvard Business School article that I read around folks who are trisector leaders, right? Mm. It's trisector leader, Sheryl Sandberg. Mm. There's a number of examples of it, right? And it's something about being able to, when you have that unique vantage point, which I think you and I have at this point in our lives and careers, be able to marshal people and resources in ways that when you don't have the credibility in those sectors, they're very hard to do. Because when I think about this from a deeply individual level, people do things for you if they trust you. Mm. How is trust built? Becomes the fascinating question. I love asking all my guests. So like, I think when you got into all of these, you know, sectors, which to the public eye, wait, what, politics versus startups? Or those are three different places that have very different implicit and explicit rules of engagement. Mm-hmm. How did Rob navigate building trust amongst those? Because there had to be nuances about how you had to like figure it out.
Oh, that's a fantastic question. And I think according to the extant research, the number one way to build trust, I didn't realize this, I was doing it implicitly. The number one way to build trust is to trust other people. And it's difficult.
I wish people just knew that from the get, but it's funny you quoted research. I'm just like, well, of course.
And it's one of those things, right? And it's hard because we're in such a defensive time. We're in such a manic time. And so a lot of times we want to be poker faced because it's for self-preservation. It's for self-protection. Yeah, and in some circumstances and in many, that is ideal and the best way to show up. But when it comes to building trust and building teams and being seen as credible and being heard and having that word influence, it requires giving out that trust. And so trust is built on vulnerability. And if you're able to be vulnerable with people, first with yourself, actually being vulnerable, saying there, I have strengths and I have weaknesses. The bigger my strengths, the bigger my weaknesses. And so it's admitting to ourselves that in our weaknesses, we have blind spots. And there may be blind spots that people in those industries don't see. And they may have blind spots that we see because we're from an outsider's perspective. And it's so obvious to us that it's not obvious to them. So I think first it's coming in with this notion of trusting them. And being humble about the fact that they know more, maybe in terms of technical side of things, they know more people, they've had more experience, but not discounting yourself and discounting your experiences in terms of saying that they're not relevant. I'll give you an interesting example. When I became a professor at UCLA, which is a wonderful job, I remember feeling this anxiety because my career wasn't like most other professors. I didn't go off initially and get a PhD and then start teaching and researching. I did all of these other things. And I went back to school many years later. And I didn't have the publication track record. And I didn't have the speaking track record. I didn't have all of these things. And I was comparing myself to them on these really narrow margins. But then I thought to myself, as I was getting feedback from students, and they're telling me, man, your classes are so different and they're so full of life and they're so practical and they're so relevant and it's unlike anything you've ever experienced. And I thought to myself, wait a second, my one advantage compared to my colleagues is that I've actually lived life. I've actually had a job and that's outside of teaching. And most of my students will have jobs that are not in teaching or academia. And so they value that experience. And so I turned what my colleagues may look at as a disadvantage into an advantage. And so I think when you're going in building trust, you may look at things that people perceive as disadvantages and say, actually, how can we reframe this to be something positive and something advantageous for them? And so like in UCLA's case, it's advantageous that they have faculty that have actually been out there and lived around the world and done different things and can see things outside of the research that. Because research, I mean, 70% of research, Ron, can't be replicated. That's a crazy thing. There's so much academic fraud that exists. And it's not necessarily because...
Are you going to the Cat Williams world here, Rob Roberts?
What's interesting is that if you look at amazing mainstream publications like The Atlantic, for example, or scholars like Arthur Brooks, they're talking increasingly about these types of things, that it's not necessarily because scholars have bad motives or that because they are not trained, it's because there's a disincentive to produce research that is not in line with what the established orthodoxy or expectation is.
Yeah,
I think the same thing is true in other industries. When you're coming in, there's an orthodoxy and an expectation that you show up a certain kind of way. So that could be in your resume should look like ABC, and or your personality should be like XYZ. Then when your resume isn't either of those things, or your resume and personality aren't either of those things, it violates the orthodoxy. And so when you're building trust, it really means that you have to be very aware of it, because people will implicitly look at you as an outsider. And so it's building those things. And it's just being personable, it's being friendly, and it's exhibiting the traits of persuasion and charisma that really carry across different sectors. I think most people overestimate the amount of technical experience that they need in order to be successful when switching careers. I think that people need less than they think. Most of our skill sets are transferable. Now, especially when you start, like you were talking about, on the higher levels like the Sheryl Sandbergs, the higher you get, the more transferable your skill sets are. Now, if you're entry level as an engineer, maybe that's a little bit different. But as you age and as you get experience, it's so different.
Yeah. That's so fascinating to me, right? Because this idea of like your story and anecdotes of building trust, right? Which come from the value of, well, trust others from the get, right? I think, you know, what I often talk about when I've talked about how I build and cultivate relationships and I've coached people on doing it, right? Because at some level, it feels like, I think for folks like you and I, this feels intuitive, but this has been a built upon foundation of like lots of reps and lots of experience and lots of reflection. And when I think of this idea of trusting others came from seeing my parents in action, which I talk about over and over again online and in the podcast, right? Is my parents were masterful at trusting others. Now, that come from their Philippine cultural values that I talk about and I think try to live. One of them in particular that's really important to me. There's a couple, right? But one that comes is Kapwa. Kapwa loosely translated shared unity, interconnectedness. My kind of quick description of it is my fate is tied to your fate. And to be clear, right, if you think about like team sports, team anything, collaboration, if I see that my fate is tied to your fate, I'm going to learn to trust you. And if I don't, then it's going to be really hard for us to get to real easy, right? And so I think by watching my parents' example as a young kid, I saw that as a value to want to extend and deepen, right? And to be clear, this is where the conversation about identities comes into play, right? I think I've been mindful that my cis maleness, one, two, my Filipino-ness, my Asian-ness as like outwardly seen identities. And mind you, I'm wearing a shirt that says Filipino mixed, so you can't get confused. Like, what kind of Asian is he? Right? On my shirt, just in case you didn't know, right? Or I have to speak with some far Philippine accent, which I don't have an accent like from back home because I was born in America. But the thing that I learned from my parents was just treat people well. That's how you trust others. There's a certain like way to be genuinely curious with people, right? Listen to people, follow up. Like there's something about, you know, it's like classic, like, Four Agreements, Miguel Ruiz stuff, right? Be a person, be impeccable where you were. It's all those things, right? That for me is like the formula for charisma, because charisma is not, admittedly, when I think about that, like I'm your extrovert. Like I know I have charisma, but it's not enough to be extroverted to be charismatic. It's not. I've met a lot of extroverted people who are like very uncharismatic, right? Absolutely. And I know that a lot of my charisma and reading a book that someone put me onto, I'm forgetting the author's name, it was like teaching people how to be charismatic, right? That there's a formula to this. Like, I think sometimes we put on these myths of what it takes to get things done. And what I love about your story, Rob, is, wait a second, I've shown a roadmap and you teach people this, you've written books about this to say, you know, even though these sectors and industries and jobs have had these gatekeepers, these implicit rules. Here's what I've done to break those things. And let me teach y'all how to do these things too, because it is accessible. Is it easy? No. But is it accessible? Yes.
Absolutely.
So I'm curious, like, what are you up to these days? What do you want to share with the audience? Like, what is Rob up to today? UCLA professor, there's other stuff I know you have going on. Why don't you tell the audience, what do you have going on right now?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's one of my pride and joys, is being able to be in the classroom. And I look at education as transformation. I look at it as a way to empower people to become their best selves. My biggest goal in life, whether it's in teaching or in books or in movies, is to grow big people. People that have big minds full of wisdom and full of knowledge and full of skill, big hearts full of self-compassion and empathy for others, and big action so that they can be, you know, unafraid of taking that next step in order to pursue their dreams. And so that's, I think everything's reunited around this goal of how can I grow big people? And I think I didn't have this goal when I was younger, because us being born in the States, we have this very individual mindset that it's about our own achievement. And we're trained and indoctrinated with that from a very early age. And it's reinforced in school, in work, online, in society. And it wasn't until I really started to realize that other people matter that it started to become much more of a thing. There's a great African proverb that goes along with what you're saying. If you want to go fast, you go alone. If you want to go far, you go with others. And I didn't realize just how much we need each other, that we are our brother's keeper. And I think that right now, America doesn't understand that story, that doesn't understand that Republicans need Democrats, Blacks need whites. We all need each other. And I just wrote a book called Of King and King about the Civil Rights Movement. Now I'm kind of researching a book about the Civil War. And I don't think people really understand what those eras were like. And 50% of people think we're going into the Civil War, and it's scary. And what it did to this country years ago, decades ago, or a century ago, first in the 60s, kind of a cold Civil War in a way. And then, of course, a century before that, with the actual Civil War, we're on a dangerous precipice. So for me, that kind of goal of building big people and seeing where we are in the zeitgeist and society and culture, I'm really focused on how can we create more empathy? And how can we train that? How can we coach that? How can we teach that? How can we empower people with that to see beyond their own perspective, to admit to themselves that they may be wrong and that other people may be right? And I mean, our brain has a desire to be right. We get rewarded with dopamine by feeling we're right. And there's a thing called motivated reasoning, where even if you present people with information that contradicts their beliefs, they're going to deny it, because they can't see any fault in their own thinking, and they can only see fault in others. And so it's this, like, we excuse ourselves, our thinking and our behavior, and we accuse other people. So it's this dance of excusing and accusing, excusing and accusing. And so for me, a big part of it is united around this idea of, hey, we all kind of have these crooked hearts, and we're trying to do the best that we can, and to give each other grace and the benefit of the doubt as we move through life together. So I'm just doing a number of book projects that are related to that. And I'm writing a book called The Creative Leader with the Jeopardy producer. You know, and I'm researching the Civil War book right now. I've got some movie projects that are going on with one of the stars of Destiny's Child. And just the different things.
Wait, with who that. Again? I say that again, Rob? With Destiny's Child?
One of the former members of Destiny's Child. And
very
was
cool.
It was unexpected, and a Christmas story and whatnot. And so I think when you announce your goals when they're about other people, all of a sudden opportunities just flow. And so, like, with that movie, with the Destiny's Child star, just flowed. Or there are other things, like I'm doing this empathy project with Harvard. And when I say flow, I mean, I've realized that the more I lean into this purpose of empowering others to be big people, the less I actually have to go out and do things in terms of reaching for things. In other words, people come to me with their ideas and their projects. I'm more of a magnet than I am a hustler, if that makes any sense.
This is once again why I see Russ connected us. That's a lot of how I've unintentionally, but now very explicitly and intentionally, guide my life and my energy, right? Mm-hmm. Is that When I think about it, like day two of a business development client relations job, what is at the heart of my value? Why I think I'm going to do well in that? It's previous experience, right? For sure, right? I've done a similar job at my last company, but that's the easy stuff. But the why, what's the value? What's the thing? It's really around trusting others, one conversation at a time, trust first, transaction second, and being able to just have a level of persistence and follow-up. Right? This persistence and follow-up for me, so I'll give a really even specific, tangible example. LinkedIn loves when people get new jobs. Loves.
It's true.
Crack of LinkedIn, right? Because think about it from a empathy perspective, right? Like, oh my God, like people are winning. And so of course, LinkedIn, like any of the social media tools, is trying to create feelings and evoke things to get people to be on the platform and start paying for things and engage in a platform. It's not rocket science, right? And so surprise, surprise, whenever you put a new thing, job that you have, LinkedIn built probably, I would say roughly 2 or 3 years ago, I don't remember the exact timeline. Hey, you can put an announcement out. It is an automatic thing, right? So I have the nice little picture and then they fill in the blank. They put a statement for you. If it's all you want to put. I already knew that I was going to do that when I accepted this job. Stronger. Shout out to my friends at Stronger Consulting, Mike Montoya, Keish, and our sales coach, Amira, amongst others. And what's interesting about the post is that people then start to say, congrats. People start to like it. Why would that matter in my business, Rob? I'm sure we already know the answer, but let me tell the audience. Why does that matter that I did that? Aside from like feeling good, like pat on the back. Yeah, I got a new job. Yay, right? It's the follow-up. What am I doing right now as a strategy in terms of business development, client relationships? I'm looking through all the people I said congrats, Ron, starting on LinkedIn to see who do I need to send the message to. So I'm spitting the game on like classic sales 101 to go ahead and reach out to people, say, hey, blank, I'd love to, you know, catch up and learn more about what you're up to, like canned language, and share a little bit about what I'm doing at Stronger Consulting. I particularly want to see if there is a need for our, you know, hiring or talent consulting service, or if you know anyone. More about us here, website, scheduling link. I've sent that to 30 people already. I already have 3 responses.
Wow.
Right?
Wow.
It's just
a huge response rate.
Like Russ, no, because I've talked to him, like I'm maniacal about these things, right? And it comes from because I trust, like, and it's like, I think similar to you, you probably have an encyclopedic trust Rolodex.
That's a great way to say it. I'm going to steal that, Ron.
Okay, no, you should, right? Don't put it so just to me.
You trigger it the first time, the second time you know, say somebody else said this. And then the third time you basically like, it's mine. That's sort of how it works.
Yeah. But what's fascinating is that's the way I think about living, trusting others, because I think sometimes what happens, and I'm so big picture by nature, and I'm an ideator, I'm in the clouds, is to remember, like a lot of things in life, not everything comes easily for us, right? It's in the things that have not come easily that I've had the best learning. Salsa dancing, swimming, amongst other things, right? There are some physical things that have come easily for me, right? Like I'm a powerlifter now, so that's come easily to me. And I put easy in quotes, but the amount of time that I'm consumed being on Instagram and watching videos and thinking about form and asking for feedback and trusting my body, I found when you enjoy something and there's a level of trust in yourself, but particularly others, because I think if you don't trust others, then you won't get feedback from others because you might hear it. You don't take it. It's like, what the F is that? Wow. Dr. Rob, what? Okay, doctor, right?
Yeah,
what is this?
Absolutely.
Everything? I can't trust people. Like, no. Figuring out how based on our identities. So I'm curious about like what you're positing in terms of like societally, systemically. How do we start helping others build empathy? Like that fascinates me, right? Because I really think about it on a micro level. That's where I think I get the most joy, but I'm also fascinated by like, how do we start building this?
That's a great question. And when I first started thinking about it, I remember talking to a colleague who's at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. And I said, have you ever felt that you needed to do something, but also thought that you would probably fail in doing it? And it was just one of those types of things, because it's this huge thing that we really need to see happen. And then I started doing some self-examination and some inventorying of my motivations and of my expectations. And I realized that because of where society has been, I allowed myself to grow cynical. I allowed myself to grow essentially hopeless in a way. And I realized that as a teacher and a leader and as somebody who tells stories and wants to inspire people, that one of my chief traits and abilities was the ability to be hopeful and give hope. And that was somehow taken from me without me even realizing it. And so I had to recalibrate my expectations that it is possible. And I had to move away from the language and the thinking of, well, it's so big that it can never be achieved. And here's the thing, sometimes some goals are so big that, you know, you can't necessarily achieve it on your own, but you can achieve it with other people. And so as it relates to it, I think there are practical ways to do it in terms of trainings in K-12 and K-8 trainings in school, but also there are ways to do that out in society. And I think a big part of it is people don't have self-compassion. I think it starts with the self. I don't think it starts with other people. I think people have to see that a lot of times they are so down on themselves. 85% of people, according to MIT research, don't feel good enough about themselves. And so a big part of it is learning people, teaching people to feel good about themselves, to like themselves. For me, it took years, Ron, to learn how to trust myself, myself. I mean, it takes time, and nobody ever. And so I think initially it's the self-compassion. It's, do I like myself? Do I trust myself? Am I not going to somehow fail or be worse off if I exhibit self-compassion? Because that's a big thing. Well, if I do this soft, mushy stuff, am I going to be less effective? Am I going to be taken for a chump? Am I, all these different thoughts that come to mind that are legitimate. And what I've realized personally, and what also the research shows, is that the more we do that, not only the more happy we are, but the more we connect with others and the greater our day-to-day lives are. So I think a big part of it is it's teaching people self-compassion and integrating that into curriculum in K-12, in higher education, and then going into workforces, whether it be academia, whether it be business, whether it be nonprofit world, or especially politics, since actually training people in self-compassion and training them to see that there are other people and that most of us have the same interests. I always give this Pew Research poll to my students, and it shows the top 50 political issues in America, because the media narratives, everybody's just disagreeing on everything in terms of specific policies. What's interesting is when you actually measure Republican and Democrats across specific issues, whether it be guns, abortion, et cetera, the amount of similarity on the issues, like as an example, gun control, 80% of Republicans want gun control. 80% of Democrats want gun control. So where's the disconnect? We are allowing the media and allowing online extreme groups to essentially focus on things that... Yeah, to get in our way. And yeah, absolutely. To get in our way of being able to unify and say we can actually get things done. So I think a big part is showing people that, okay, there's not a lot of disagreement, but also saying, hey, we're human beings and we want the same things. We want a healthy body. We want good relationships. We want success in our careers. And the more that you show people that we're more similar than dissimilar, I think the more you can start to achieve that goal of creating a healthier society. And I think when you have a healthy society, things are rocking and they're rolling. And I don't think it's inevitable that America is going to descend into this dystopian society. That is the prediction. I think that essentially we have prophets of doom that are predicting it. But I also think that there are people out there optimistic and hopeful that are doing specific tangible things to try to reverse that tide. And even if the current generation doesn't believe that, what I realized is that when you put things, like, for example, Dr. King, his ideas were mostly rejected by his generation. So,
of course,
you know, he only had a 25% approval rating.
Right.
Not just whites, but also blacks. You're like, I don't know, Dr. King.
Especially when he came out against the Vietnam War.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, he was public enemy number one. Goodness gracious.
But it wasn't until his ideas were embraced, though, not by his generation, but by the generation that followed up. And now they're just taken, they're so normalized, we don't even think about them. racial equality. We don't even think about that. And in our situation, do we have a multi-generational perspective that says, even if my generation is kind of iffy and funky on things, what about the kids? What about their kids? Can we be thoughtful enough, diligent enough, and resilient enough to keep this message out there so that the kids sort of take it for granted because we have succeeded that much with them?
Yeah. Gosh, Rob, you've dropped so many wisdom nuggets that I think there were several ronderings you dropped. But I got to ask you, because we're ending towards the end of our time together, is what's the rondering for the audience today, the lesson of value?
Ooh, that's a great question. I think two. I think the first rondering is, a business partner once told this to me. He said, surrender to the person you're called to become. Surrender to the person you're called to become.
Yeah, that because, just like stirred in my like stomach.
Right? Right? It just goes, it percolates up and it gives us tingles. And that's how I felt when I first heard it. And it's this idea of find what you're good at, what you like doing, what the world needs, and go out there and do it. Surrender to that person. And you find it, or excuse me, it'll find you. But it's not always what you think it'll be. That's the first thing. I think the second thing is when you surrender to that person, enjoy who that person is. Be satisfied with who that person is. I think one of the biggest lessons I've learned being around famous or powerful people is that most of them don't have happiness. Most of them don't have joy. Most of them don't have satisfaction. I think studies show like maybe 20% of them do. And so what I realize is that when we learn to be satisfied with what we have, doesn't mean that we don't want more, that you can't go. Okay, but when we learn to be satisfied with what is in our hand, as opposed to always looking at the birds in the bush, then life transforms. So first it starts with that surrender. Then it goes to that satisfaction. It's like, you know what? I'm satisfied in being this person. I don't need to be this other person. I'm uniquely designed to be me. And so I will leave those two ronderings for your audience, because they've been personally transformative in my life as I think about them and meditate on them day in and day out.
Oh, Rob, man, I wish we had another 7 hours to chat. We're going to have to figure out some time offline to keep collaborating. Absolutely. Your empathy project really fascinates me. It aligns with how I do my work, even though I don't do explicit empathy work, but I live that value. It just has allowed me to have tremendous opportunities and access to relationships. So
I love it.
What do you want to promote? Where do people find you before we end?
Oh, well, thanks so much. I appreciate it. Amazon, they can just kind of look up Rob Carpenter books. Yeah. There's one book in particular I think your audience would love, and that's the 48 Laws of Happiness that I've written. It's very practical, step-by-step. That's usually a favorite. I've written some other technical books. My first novels will be coming out in due order. But I think that one, offers the most amount of transformation for people who are looking to just get kind of a reset and reframe their perspective, especially for a new year and as they move forward. Because here's the thing, the more successful you become, the more you have to go back to the fundamentals and the fundamentals of happiness and joy and satisfaction. And it's constantly going back to those fundamentals. If we don't do it, it's like John Wooden, the great coach of UCLA.
Oh, I knew you were going to coach.
I had to.
Sports was in my brain.
I had to. And I have his pyramid of success. And he won 10 championships because he always brought these great athletes back to the fundamentals. What are the fundamentals? And so I think that book helps us kind of think about the fundamentals of life and what's important.
Beautiful. Dr. Rob, it was great having you as a guest on Ronderings. And as I tell listeners, we keep coming. In the words of Coach Prime, who's one of my models for branding, just one of my models of like an incredible multi-hyphenate himself, right? And so keep listening, keep finding us, keep sharing. And Dr. Rob, thank you again for your time.
No, thank you. I appreciate it.
I love the way that Dr. Rob closed this episode with this rendering of surrendering to the person you want to become. This idea of there being a trust that when you make that decision, the person you want to become, that you fall into it. You let the way that the universe and other people conspire to get you to be that person. But most of all, when you get there to be that person, enjoying it. Not trying to change it, not trying to beat it up, not all these things, but being present in the moment and enjoying it. That's sitting with me because I don't think I always enjoy the person that I am, right? There's always pursuit to get better, pursuit to get better, right? That can be exhausting at times. So I'm sitting with that. Ron Durings fan, we keep coming. We keep coming. More hot guests soon. Peace.